No risk it, no biscuit.
Coming from the Arizona desert, presented by SBNation.com. For Arizona Cardinals fans, by Arizona Cardinals fans, with outsider and insider's perspectives, this is Revenge of the Birds. Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio for one of our off-season shows. I'm your host, Jess Root. On the line is Seth Cox, joining us for another show. And welcome back. If we've just been about 3 weeks, hasn't it, Seth? How's it been for the time off for you?
Busy still. We just recorded a podcast, should be out tomorrow for the draft breakdown. Kind of a call to calm down on the elitist views from draft Twitter and such. So it was a fun show, and so that should be out tomorrow. But other than that, you know, just busy with family and vacations and hanging out with friends and just catching up with people.
And for the Arizona Cardinals, lately it has been the busy part of the offseason. This week, we're recording on a Tuesday night. Tuesday was the beginning of mandatory minicamp, but there were 3 weeks prior to this week was all about minicamp, rather about OTAs, which is just another fancy name for practice. Minicamp, which is, you know, another name for practice. So the Cardinals didn't have to be there for the first 3 weeks. It was, voluntary, but everyone was there. They didn't practice for nearly as long. They didn't have meetings for as long. And this is the week they can have them for 10 hours. So we've got a number of topics to talk about. None of them are, you know, there's not a whole lot of news other than, you know, in terms of injuries, Justin Bethel and Patrick Peterson both have been out. Tyrann Mathieu's still out. Patrick Peterson actually attended practice and participated in practice for the first time this offseason on Tuesday, doing the individual drills with his position group and sitting out for 11 on 11, 7 by 7, 7 on 7. That's the plan for this week. Justin Bethel is expected to be all set, recovering from the surgery on his fractured foot. We should be ready for training camp, which was announced will start on July 28th when they report. July 29th will be the first practice at University of Phoenix Stadium. And we knew that, aside from the team announcing it, because we find out the preseason schedule. The Cardinals will open their first 2 weeks in the preseason on a Friday. That allows them to start 15 days before that. That's the rules of the NFL. You can start training camp no earlier than 15 days before your first preseason game. That means on July 28th, conditioning test, physicals, reporting. 29th of July will be the first practice, and that'll be the first time that we get to see the real position battles. The fans will get to see it. It's not the part where in at how practices go right now in OTAs and mini camp. The press, during OTAs, it was once a week. The press were there. We get to see all of practice, but only the first 20 minutes is open. So everything that happens during the rest of the time didn't really happen. We weren't really there until you sort of try to talk around a question to bring up things that we saw with the media. So what we're planning for tonight, and I believe we are on show 119 of our Revenge of the Birds radio show, is a kind of a sneak peek. There could be changes coming to the podcast, not really other than the podcast itself. Seth and I will still be talking. Don't have any plans in terms of new shows quite yet. We might do another one next week after we find out the minicamp. I do have a couple of possible player interviews lined up. Eli or Eli Buka, the undrafted corner out of Canada. I kind of got him on the back burner for a show sometime. I might try to see if we can't record sometime. I believe I have on tap as well, undrafted tight end out of Monmouth, Hakeem Ballas. And then we'll see from there. Kind of play out what's happening between now and training camp. But let's go ahead and get to the topics. We've got a number of things that we would like to discuss, that the kind of the topics that have been bandied around over the course of the last couple of weeks. We're going to talk about Tyrann Mathieu and his deal. Will it get done? What does the Harrison Smith deal mean? We're going to talk about the center position, or, you know, A.Q. Shipley or Watford and rookie Evan Bame. We're going to talk a little bit about the receiver contract situation moving forward, as the Jaguars signed a contract extension to Allen Hurns for you know, what looks like a decent amount of money. It's kind of setting a market for what we need to look at moving forward. We're going to talk about the running back rotation, David Johnson, Chris Johnson, Andre Ellington, so forth. We're going to talk about veteran additions as we approach training camp. Are there any veteran additions that the Cardinals need to add? And then, of course, what kind of has a bunch of people all a buzz is the Amazon video show, the video series All or Nothing, the season with the Arizona Cardinals, 8 episodes through Amazon Video, coming out, premiering on July 1st. And if it weren't for the fact that I will be driving, I believe, almost all that day, heading out of town, I would be glued to my computer watching 8 hours of Cardinals video just because. So let's go ahead and get started. The show is brought to you by Audible.com, the number one audio source on the internet, where you can get audiobook downloads. And if you sign up today using Revenge of the Birds as the promo code, you visit audibletrial.com/revengeofthebirds. You can sign up and get yourself a free audiobook download, test out the service for a month, and go on from there. Again, that's audibletrial.com/revengeofthebirds to pick up your free audiobook download. So, Seth, let's go ahead and talk about a few things. So, number one, let's talk about the Tyrann Mathieu deal. Nothing's new, but we keep talking about it. Ian Rappaport said a couple of weeks ago that it is possible that it was coming soon, even as early as the end of, well, before the team breaks for the summer. That would be Thursday, and we haven't heard anything else other than the fact that he wants, you know, we're hearing highest paid safety. He wants to be paid like a top defender. There's nothing really new here other than Harrison Smith with the Vikings signed a contract extension that pays him an average of $10.25 million, which kind of sets a new bar for he's the highest paid safety until Eric Berry or Tyrann Mathieu signs. So what's the take? What do you see right now happen with Tyrann Mathieu? Do we see any hangups? Is it going to happen? Is it going to happen in training camp like the Patrick Peterson deal, or is this going to drag on for a while?
I think it's going to happen in training camp. One of our great readers of Revenge of the Birds, Gungus, wrote out an excellent kind of layout of what to expect with this contract overall. And his basis of why it'll probably be training camp is the Cardinals don't have any money to really add to it this year. So they would have to put all the money into next year. And teams don't usually like to do that. They usually like to be able to spread out some of the guaranteed money. And so it'll probably happen closer, you know, towards the end of training camp, because by that time they'll have been able to, you know, make the additions that they need, or, you know, make some cuts to free up some space, you know. So that I think we're looking at right in the middle of time, about when Patrick Peterson got his. The other thing is the Harrison Smith deal, and I tweeted this out and you wrote about it. This is the baseline for what Tyrann Mathieu is going to get paid at this point. I would be very surprised if his number came in less than 50, what was it, 52 and a half million or 51 and a half million or whatever it was. I would be very surprised if that number came in less than that. I would imagine it's going to be right around the 60 million mark over 5 years, and that'll be kind of where it's at.
And that's what, you know, the talk of highest paid safety, and one of the highest paid safety, that's kind of the term that the Cardinals have been throwing out there. And which, in terms of the NFL, that's kind of been the way to do things. You look at their position, you look at, especially for the stars of the position, and you look at the high mark. You want to make them the highest paid. That's what happened with Patrick Peterson. They made him the highest paid. It wasn't like they leapfrogged by a great amount. They saw the highest deal, paid him a little more than that, and then he was the highest paid corner. The problem is if you say highest paid safety, that means you're limiting yourself to a little bit over $10 million. You know, Earl Thomas was sort of the baseline deal at $10 million a year for 4 years. Eric Berry currently has the franchise tender, which will pay him $10.8 million this year coming up, though. So it'll be interesting where he comes in. But then you've got Patrick Peterson at the top, you know, making just a hair over $14 million a year, or Josh Norman with the average of $15 million a year. And Tyrann Mathieu is a safety, and he's a corner, though he's not an outside corner. And so he doesn't want to be labeled. And you know, part of that is for the monetary thing. He doesn't want to be labeled this or that because it's about the money. And I don't see this becoming contentious, but I'm getting the sense that, you know, I think he kind of wishes it were done already, and he's saying all the right things. But there are just little hints of this and that, you know, that the Cardinals are going to have to pay a little bit more, whether it's now, whether it's next year. They're going to have to pay. And I expect very much the same thing. The Cardinals are going to have to pay him between 12 and $13 million. He's not going to get Patrick Peterson money, but he's going to get somewhere near that, despite when it comes to the injury factor, because he's that dynamic a player. He's a game changer on defense. And, you know, we can point to things. NFL Network, I think it was Bucky Brooks, wrote a piece about Tyrann Mathieu and his value, and pointed out statistically how the Cardinals gave up on average about 9 more points a game in the games that he was absent. Now, granted, they were playing really good teams. But we saw how the defense looks different, and we can even go back to 2013 when he was out, and they saw Ryan Fitzpatrick and the Titans put up a 34 spot on the Cardinals and really have them. They didn't look anything the same defensively. Even though that first year, Mathieu wasn't a statistical machine. He wasn't filling the box score like he did in 2015. His skill set covers up for a lot of other things in the defense, and it just, like Troy Polamalu or
Bob Sanders back in the day.
Bob Sanders is the name I'm trying to come up with. Bob Sanders is their presence changes the defense. And he's going to be paid like that.
Yeah, and what it does is it allows other people to do other things. You know, all of a sudden he covers up a lot of things, weaknesses for the Cardinals. And you hope this year it's a little different, especially with Chandler Jones. But you're paying him because of what he's done. You know, that's how contracts work, unfortunately, not what they're going to do. And so we don't know exactly, you know, what he's going to be after two knee surgeries, and we don't know what he's going to be, you know, 3 or 4 years from now at the end of this contract, but we do know what he has been, and that's been, like you said, one of the most dominant players on defense in the NFL. You know, he's not going to get $100 million, but he is going to get in that $60 million range, and he deserves it because of what he does defensively for the Cardinals. So it's going to be one of those situations where it's just, you know, finding the time and the right money.
And if they insist on doing the deal now or before the year, because their current salary cap thing, they're going to have to do it a little bit more creatively instead of a lot of upfront money. In the term of a signing bonus, they might have to use the term option bonus, because roster bonuses, if you look at the salary cap, roster bonuses hit the salary cap in that year alone. Signing bonus will prorate. An option bonus will prorate as well, I believe. So what they might have to do is pay him a couple million in a signing bonus up front this year, and then pay him not necessarily a roster bonus, but one of those option bonuses come next offseason to then spread it spread it out a little bit more across the remaining 5 years, which is, I'm sure that they would like to add 5 years to this year, kind of like with Patrick. So
yeah, so not only is he 6 years,
essentially six more seasons.
Yeah.
Putting him through, I guess, be through 2022, I think it would be, if I'm correct, maybe it'd be just 2021. So we'd take him through this year. So it'd be 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. So on there, right. So it would just be through 2021. Oh, wait. Oh, no, no, because he's got one more. He's a – that's right. His I keep thinking about Patrick's was different because he had the fifth-year option.
Yeah, yeah. So his will be –
that's what it is.
Yeah.
It'd be through 2021.
Yeah, and so that's – and, you know, what I was trying to lay out and look at was the fact that it was – you know, you're going to have to figure out a middle ground between – the money he can make and what you want to guarantee him up front, because let's face it. I mean, he's injury, I guess, prone.
He's an injury risk.
Yeah. He's a high injury risk at this point. And you know, you don't want to just give him 40 million guaranteed. You want it to be, you know, one of those escalated bonuses that improve, you know, that goes up and down over time and whatnot. So, and you know, based on time played, because guess what happens soon? You know, God forbid he blows out another knee or anything else, and you, right. You know, you're on the hook for all the money, but guess what? He's not going to play. So that's what you want to figure out.
I think what I would, if I were to structure, you know, ideally, if they can do the option bonus, I would probably throw him 5 million in a signing bonus off the bat, so it doesn't hit the cap very much. I would give him another option bonus next offseason of, say, 10 million, and then that prorates for the 5 years, just tacking on. And then from there, I would, for the years after that, structure it a lot like how they do a lot of these contracts that are essentially year to year, where you have a roster, big roster bonus. And that, in terms of it, if you're not super familiar with NFL contracts, players only get paid game checks. So when they sign, if they got a $2 million salary for this year, that means the only paychecks they're getting are 17 weeks of paychecks during the football season and nothing else in between. If you're like, if that's like you and I, and that's a good sum of money, not having an income week to week is, or week to every other week, that's really unnerving. They do get some stipends for off-season work, for workouts, for OTAs, for training camp, for mini camp. But those roster bonuses, like, it's kind of a one, it escalates the decision-making process of the future with the team. And two, it gets the, it gives the player a chunk of money in the off-season. It's kind of a way to spread out that cash throughout the year. And I think I would do pretty – then you do a sizable roster bonus each year after year two, kind of the way that, you know, – then you have to make a decision on this contract. And I would – every year I would put an injury clause in there, but it would be to protect him. But at the same time, it then – I'm a big fan of protected players, especially with the way other sports work. So if you've got an $8 million roster bonus coming up, or a $10 million roster bonus coming up for the next year, whatever the amount is, it's guaranteed for injury. So if he happens to finish that season injured, and he's not, if it's another type knee injury, he's going to get that next roster bonus. But then the next off season, that then, well, after you paid that, you could cut him. If it comes down to that. So I would structure it like that, a little bit less of a signing bonus, than give him an option bonus next off season, and then put the guaranteed in a lot of roster bonuses as opposed to salary in the years to come.
Yep. And I'm with you there. That's, you know, what you want to do with him at this point is make sure that you're not losing too much money or anything like that.
But you still want to make sure that you protect the player, and that's what the agent's for. In the NFL, it's – and I'm going to stand on the soapbox when it comes to the NFL. They've got to I don't understand how the NFL can continue to do what it does and make the money that it does not guarantee its contract. In the world, if I made a decision about player contracts, and I would kind of go this, I would guarantee the next year's entire salary. If a player makes it to the week one roster, we'll say a vested veteran, because that's kind of how they do things. A vested veteran makes it to the week one roster. For what the league does now, that guarantees your salary all through this season. I would make it so it guarantees the contract for the following season, and that does a couple of things. One, it protects the player, because football is a violent sport, and it's terrible when because of an injury, players just get tossed and their career's over. And two, it would also hasten contract negotiations for players who are entering their final year, because you would want to get a contract extension to guarantee that next year once you're on the roster. And I think it would be a good sort of a compromise between player and team to, if you guarantee the next year's salary, it would protect them. And it would also, I think it would drive the price down a little bit, because you would have less players actually hitting free agency potentially.
Right, and that's the whole thing about the NFL in general, is that this money's all monopoly money. None of it's real, and so, you know, with the whole cap, you know, Kaepernick contract about all the money he got paid, and everybody's like, oh, I can't. But then you sat down and look, and it's like, wow, that was genius. Like, they can basically walk away for nothing from him, like, anytime they want to. Like, they haven't yet, but they can without any repercussions. So, you know, it protects the team, but it also incentivizes the player if they're not playing well, type thing. So that's what, you know, that's kind of the happy medium you have to be okay with NFL contracts at this point.
So that's now, so you see there being any other obstacle other than their own salary cap issue? Do you see this becoming at all potentially a little contentious? I don't think so, but I can see how it could. A player like Matthew, who's overcome what he's done, overcome what he's overcome, and the fact that he is so popular and he is also so impactful, that, you know, he's saying the right things, but I wonder if there is a little bit of, you know, well, if anything else, tired of talking about it. And I hope that doesn't. I know everything gets better once you sign the deal and the money's in the bank, but, you know, I wonder if this hurts Matthew a little bit now, simply because it's dragging on much longer than anyone probably thought would happen.
Maybe, but I mean, that's the reality of contracts at this time, is that you have a player that is wanting to get paid, and you have a team that wants to protect itself as much as possible, especially, and again, I don't mean this in a negative way, you know, it against a player that is great but is perpetually not on the field. So that's, you know, that's what you are trying to figure out. And so, yeah, I could see it becoming an issue. I don't think it's going to, but I mean, it does make sense in that instance that it could become, like you said, contentious eventually down the road.
So let's kind of move on from the contract situation of Matthew. Let's talk about, there's actually, we do have another contract thing to discuss, but kind of one of the position battles that's of particular interest. So we'll get onto that next. We're going to talk centers. We're going to talk the three centers of, well, we thought there were just two, but now there's three. So next on the show, we'll talk centers and the center battle, A.Q. Shipley, Earl Watson, Evan Bain, and what's going on there. We talk centers. Right now we've got A.Q. Shipley and Evan Bain. Everyone thought that was going to be the thing. Earl Watson is suddenly in the mix, right? This is something new. Was that something that surprised you when you heard it? Because it was for me, considering comments from last year. Now, Earl Watford, for me, I find it comedic. I kind of find it really funny, is it seems now for the last three off seasons, Bruce Arians makes it a point to praise Earl Watford for something, saying they got to find a place for him, and yet they never really find a place for him. He was pushing Jonathan Cooper 2 years ago. He was pushing Bobby Massey last year, and he got the couple of starts there. He was pushing Cooper last year as well. And the thing funny is that when they talked about his versatility last year, he was terrible at center. But now he's getting significant reps. He's shocking the coaches, and he's in the mix. I mean, how real do you think the possibility of Earl Watford playing center in an actual game in 2016?
You know, I don't see it coming to fruition. I think it's Shipley and then Bame, but you know, Watford's one of those guys that I think we all continue to like really root for and expect to take the next step. And then he's just a guy that's depth, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, especially from a fourth round pick, you know, and people have a hard time with that. Especially when that fourth round pick is like a quarterback or something, but sometimes, you know, late round draft picks are just special teams players and depth and good depth. All that being said, I think Earl Watford is going to get paid this offseason and somebody's going to give him a chance to become a starter in this league. You know, probably like a 2-year, $5-6 million deal that the Cardinals won't want to match because they're not going to want to pay a backup, you know, $3 to $4 million a year.
Right, right. And you know, the way I see the whole Earl Watford thing, and I in jest tweeted out the thing about the off-season stories because Bruce Arians had said once, you know, he said it again for the third year in a row, light years ahead, it's like night and day. So what are some other things? Well, he's going to say this, he's going to say, and there's going to be something about Earl Watford. And lo and behold, about a week later, there was something about Earl Watford.
The other thing is that there's always a cornerback that's, you know, going to push, you know, to be the guy across from Patrick Peterson. And, you know, they'll inevitably say he has more it could be the best athlete or best corner on the team or most athletic corner on the team or something of that nature. And Brandon Williams is already kind of getting that treatment.
He is. That is very, very true. But I look at Watford and you know, comments today after practice. You know, A.Q. Shipley is unquestioned the starter right now. And Arian said as much, what will he have to do to fend off Bame, Evan Bame? He says he's got to stay on the field. So as long as, at least for right now, because what he said that Bame is still in rookie mode where he's still got, you know, he's still on overload learning things. He actually said today that Bame would be the third string center if everything happened now. Now he was not down on Bame in the least and said he has a bright future, and I think he expects very good things even this year. But it's interesting to think, you know, in the comment last week in minicamp, or rather in OTAs, is the reason why Earl's there at center is more about depth. They want to dress seven offensive linemen, and that allows them potentially to do so. Even though he had a very Ricky Bobby quote, I joke about it with some of the other writers out there in practice. If you're a backup, you're a starter. Now I understand where he's coming from. It doesn't make any sense. If you're a backup, you're a starter. No. And you're an offensive lineman and you're a backup, you're not a starter, but you're always just a play away. I'm going to say it right now, Earl Watford is not going to be the starting center. He's probably not going to start any game this year. Well, that's not true. Evan Mathis could probably get hurt, and Earl Watford might start a right guard at some point this year, a game or two. But he's going to be solid depth. I actually think it will be A.Q. Shipley who starts at least the start of the year, when we may see Bame take over later in the year. But I'm not willing to say that even Bame's going to win this starting job coming out of camp.
You know, and that's one of those things that you talk about with continuity. And offensive line is just a different animal, right? Like, quarterback and offensive line are you don't really have a chance to play, especially in Bane's case, if you're – and I don't mean this in a negative way, but if you're just a center, like, you're not going to get reps. You're not going to get, you know – live bullets, blah blah blah, all the cliches and stuff of that nature. You know, you're going to be stuck on the bench behind the starters and having to figure out, you know, the speed of the game from off the field. And then, you know, heaven forbid you're thrust into a situation and, you know, you have to play and compete well. And so that's, you know, that's what ends up happening. And so we'll see. I'm kind of with you. I don't see it happening. I think it's at this point going to be Shipley, and then from there.
As long as he's healthy. I think Shipley will start as long as he's healthy. And I think over the course of the year, if Shipley happens to get hurt at all, I think that will be the door that Evan Bame steps into and takes over. Shipley is such an interesting player to me because they brought him in last year and they signed him. Everyone thought he was going to be the starting center. Then his contract came out. I said, now wait, they're not paying him $700,000 planning on having him be the starting center. And then it turns out that's not what happened. But Shipley is a guy that the Cardinals tried to acquire, I think, for three off seasons. And were, you know, it finally worked on the third off season. They were able to get him. Arians was familiar with him in Pittsburgh. He was familiar with him in Indy. But as a player, they really want to have him there. But yet it seems every team is so quick to replace him. He was, you know, Pro Football Focus loved him in Indy in 2013, and he was benched for a rookie. And it was one of the interesting stories that it was never really explained. They bring him into the Cardinals, and then what do? In the middle of the train, at the beginning of the train, they bring back Lyle Sendlin. And it's hard to wonder, you know, obviously they like him, but they don't like him enough not to bring someone else in. And then they, you know, Lyle Sendlin is gone. Shipley looks like he's going to step. What do? They draft a center. So he seems to be a guy that they're always looking to replace. He's a guy they trust well enough that they can trust could do the job, but they don't see him as any sort of – they don't look at him with any long-term plans at all, any team apparently.
No, and that's the thing. Shipley's the perfect – like he's going to be a 10 to 12-year journeyman interior offensive lineman that starts – you know, in 10 years, maybe 50 games. And that, you know, maybe he gets up to 75 games and that's going to be his legacy. And that's going to be who he is. And he's going to make, you know, $15 to $20 million over that time. And it's going to just be a very quiet, but successful career. And, he's limited physically, and that's just the reality of the situation. I mean, anybody that's built like he is, and I can say this from the fact that I'm built like he is. I'm 6 foot, you know, 2.5, and I have very short arms. And he is the same person. I think I read somewhere his arm in length was under 30 inches in terms of reach. I mean, that's short for a man his size. And so,
and the first time I actually heard it, I'd seen it in comment sections and I'd heard it from analysts. Today was the first day that I heard it from a coach when the offensive coordinator Harry Goldwin was on the radio and he talked about his short arms and he said, you know, he's got those short arms and, you know, they're not going to grow anymore. So if he apparently tries to get a little too aggressive, which gets him off balance, and well, you know
when you have when you're
he's that's just who he is. They trust him, but they only trust him so much,
right? And that's the life of a guy. I don't even know if he was drafted. I'd have to look. I think he was drafted in the fifth round, but I could be wrong fifth about that. Round, and sure. You know, that's the life of a fifth or sixth round pick. Like that's the life of Earl Watford that he's going to have. You know, you're constantly trying to get one big contract, one payday, because, you know, year to year. Yeah. I mean, you and I would obviously in a heartbeat take $700,000 a year to, you know, travel around the country and suit up on Sundays. But it's also, you know, it's also their passion and their job. And they want to, you know, they want a chance to be great too.
It was actually a seventh round pick in Pittsburgh. Okay. Seventh round of 2009. So he was a Bruce Arians guy even back when he was drafted.
And that's the thing, is he stuck around and, you know, he's made a nice living for himself. And, you know, he's one of those guys that's just going to continue to stick around and be on teams because he's smart, he's competitive, and he's going to push everybody to be better. So
they've got themselves – that'll be an interesting to see in training camp, especially if Baim kind of figures things out to see where he – if he progresses at all, because as it's been Shipley and Watford sharing first team reps and Baim handling the second team reps. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly or how that goes come training camp. If they Shipley and Watford continue to share snaps, if they do 1, 2, 3, and if Baim makes any progress from there, I'm interested to see that.
The next topic we wanted to talk about
would be. And it's one that you wrote about, and I don't know, Seth actually writing something. He kind of taken a hiatus because of how crazy things are getting around in personal life. He actually wrote something over on RevengeOfTheBirds.com, and it was about Michael Floyd or John Brown. Which one will the Cardinals or should the Cardinals pay? And that comes on the heels of what was the deal for Allen Hurns? It was 4 years, 40?
4 years, $40 million. Only $16 million guaranteed. But, you know. 4 years, $40 million. That's a nice contract.
And he's not considered a number one receiver, correct?
No, he's their clear number two receiver. You know, the little difference is that he was an undrafted free agent. So he's coming into year three. He was the same class as John Brown. And so we'll see, you know, what happens there, but he was in the same class as John Brown, and yeah, he got paid. I mean, he got a nice contract.
And we saw, what was it, Jerome Simpson, a talented, promising player. Didn't he get $8 million a year somewhere this offseason and meant to be a solid number two? And we have been kind of hemming and hawing at the fact, well, whether the Cardinals should have a year ago. Picked up the fifth-year option on Michael Floyd, and he's going to get paid a little over $7 million. And so the market is kind of being set now, $8 to $10 million for a number two receiver. And here we go with the Cardinals. After this season, they have Larry Fitzgerald no longer under contract, Michael Floyd no longer contract, and they enter the offseason – when they probably are going to want to extend John Brown's contract based on everything we've seen about John Brown and his progression, the fact that he was drafted by Bruce Arians. So tell us, you know, kind of what your mindset was of your, the basically the question, what is the problem? What is the question that runs into whether you decide or how much these should, which one of these guys that you should pay?
I think what ends up happening is you look at this and you say to yourself, I have two guys that have played considerably even in terms of statistics and you know, production on the field. And then you look at it from this route. If you look at invested monies already, Michael Floyd was the 13th overall pick. You know, let's just call it like it is. He's been a nice player. He hasn't, I would say he probably has not met expectations. You know, I've seen that blame placed on, well, the first 2 years were with Wiz and Hunt and those quarterbacks, or the first year, whatever. Yeah, year, you know, was on Wiz and Hunt and those quarterbacks. You know, and I went back and I looked and, you know, his two seasons, or his season before and his second season, which was the first one I believe with Carson Palmer, are the same as the last two seasons when, you know, John Brown's been there. So statistically speaking, they're the exact same. And so what are you know, where's the growth? Is there growth? Can you count on Michael Floyd to be a consistent guy and pay him $10 million? On the same token, you've seen growth from year one to year two from John Brown. And so you're looking at the chance that, you know, Arians talked about it, I think, a couple days ago. He left 400 yards on the field, you know, almost 200 of which in the Philadelphia game because of drops. We all remember the Philadelphia game and the drops.
Oh.
And I mean, he maybe two touchdowns. You know, obviously 200 yards is hyperbole, but he left plenty of yards on the field. So your question is, what do you do? Do you sign one of these guys now? And obviously John Brown, you don't sign now, but you look to extend Michael Floyd now at this rate of $10 million a year, knowing that this is probably going to end up being the going rate for, wide receivers of his ilk production wise through four seasons, and hope that the next 2 years he outplays that contract and you get a deal? Or do you sign John Brown next year to, you know, a T.Y. Hilton type deal, you know, of that nature? T.Y. Hilton's making $11 million a year. He had similar, you know, he's a little more productive than John Brown in his first two seasons. So that's the question. What do you do? Because I think the worst thing you can do, and this is just me personally, is you sign both of them to four-year, $40 million deals. You invest $80 million in the wide receiver core, and then you have Matt Barkley and Andrew Stanton in 2018 throwing to two guys that haven't proven, you know, as of this time, this podcast, this conversation, to be worth, you know, to be the guys on a team. So that was the question I had. And would you, you know, do you think you can pay one of these guys number two money right now in the NFL and feel comfortable with it? Everybody knows my philosophy on wide receivers. I don't pay them. That's just me. I think you can get production unless you have a special player, a Larry Fitzgerald or a Calvin Johnson, who, by the way, have, you know, zero Super Bowls between the two of them. I just think that wide receiver is a replaceable commodity, and it's something that, you know, you can consistently get production without having to invest heavily. Now, that being said, I would 100% be on board with signing one of them. For me, it'd be John Brown. I just think he's a more diverse wide receiver who wins in different ways. But if they sign Michael Floyd, I would completely understand that because he's a different type of wide receiver than anybody they have on the roster. And maybe you hope that this, you know, this is the year, like we say every year, this is the year that he breaks out and becomes that guy that we've all been waiting to see. But I just don't, I would not advocate signing both of them. I think you could draft a wide receiver next year and plug them in and probably get 600 to 800 yards from them in season one. And that's what you're going to get, you know, from your number two or three guy, which, you know, in this offense, Brown and Floyd are interchangeable as the two and three.
As we saw last season. Yeah. Now the kind of the wild card into this is, you know, what happens with Fitz. And I think that's kind of where they're at with Floyd. If they get if they know that Fitz is retiring, I think they make a frantic attempt to get Floyd signed before free agency hits.
Yeah, because he's probably going to get overpaid in free agency. Let's not away from that idea either.
Because he was a guy this year, you know, Arians has said he probably should have had, he would have had a 1,500-yard season if it weren't for getting hurt early on. He was, you know, he has that sort of potential. And I think I've said it a couple of times. I don't remember if I've actually said it on the air, but he's been a victim of the shadow of Larry Fitzgerald, so he hasn't been able to take over as that one. And so he's still kind of in that place. And I've wondered if there were no fits on this team, if Floyd wouldn't be a more impactful player. Now, he's also had he's had the little injury bug. He seems to every year have some sort of hamstring issue at some point. He had the horrible finger injury last year in camp. But, you know, in terms of a type of receiver, I like having a Michael Floyd on my team, I think, more than I like having a John Brown. But with what Bruce Arians does offensively and with his red receiver routes, it makes sense to have a John Brown. That's the type of receiver he's always gotten. But Michael Floyd is he's a different type of receiver that Arians has ever had, because he provides that size and speed combo and ball skills. And my old school thinking for football, I like that more. But the NFL today is more about the Antonio Brown, T.Y. Hilton, and John Brown style. And now, if I could get both, you know, if I could get both signed to number two money, I'm not completely against that. Now, does that perhaps hamstring things later? Not necessarily. If they end up going the draft route for a quarterback, they manage to draft their quarterback of the future. That means you've got 3 to 4 years of a cheap quarterback. And that allows you to have those. Now, if you're going with Stanton and Barkley, that's a different story, because you're not going to get the production. But if they solve the quarterback situation through the draft, they can afford to pay those guys. So, but if you've got Carson Palmer still, then it becomes a problem, because you've got to highly pay Carson Palmer, and then you're paying two guys, you know, really good money. So you'd have to replace one. If Carson Palmer's sticking around, you have to replace one through the draft.
Exactly. And the thing that you look at and the thing that you watch, you know, with all of this is what do the good, consistently good teams do? And, you know, are the Cardinals, is it fair to call the Cardinals a consistently good team yet? I don't know. Like, would you say that they're there now?
They're on track to be.
Or does this season, like, do they need to do it again this season and then they're there? That's another conversation for another day anyways. But, you know, what the consistently good teams do is they find a quarterback. Clearly, you know, you look at the Saints in their heyday, you know, before Drew Brees got old, and you look at obviously the Patriots. Hell, you can look at the Panthers if we're going to label the Cardinals, and you look at obviously now the Seahawks, and you know those teams, they don't pay wide receivers. They just don't. Or if they do, they pay a wide receiver, right? Like, yes, they pay one wide receiver. And then everybody else kind of takes a, you know, pay cut, or they just put together a group of guys that can get the job done consistently, find ways to get
open. Because a great quarterback can make good receivers really good.
Yeah, and so
and can take okay receiver and take okay receivers and make them good. Take a look at Peyton Manning over the years. He's taken a number of, you know, pretty all right receivers and turned them into stars. Tom Brady takes every short white guy and turns them into a slot receiver machine.
Yep. And so that's what you're looking at with this, is you're saying, okay, I've been paying Larry Fitzgerald. I mean, obviously you've been paying Larry Fitzgerald, you've been paying Carson Palmer at this point as well. What's next? Like, who do I pay, and how much do I pay them? And like you said, if you can get a cheap quarterback, that makes all the difference in the world.
But that runs into that's where we have the challenge now. How long is Palmer going to be around? And say, if they win the big one this year, do they end up blowing things up? Do they look like this? Do they look like the Broncos a year from now? I don't know. And so that these are big questions to have. And as things look right now, it doesn't look like Michael Floyd's going to be back, which means he's going to get, as long as he's productive this year, he'll get himself a very, very healthy deal.
Yep. And you know, that's good for him, and that's what you want. So, you know, that's what, honestly, that's what you want to try to do.
So kind of wrapping up the part on so now I'm not talking contracts at all, but coming up next, let's talk about the running back rotation and kind of go through the last route of the show. So next up on Revenge of the Birds Radio, talk running backs, talk about veteran additions, and then talk a little bit about the new video that's coming out. As we look at the running back rotation, back on Revenge of the Birds Radio, we have an interesting dynamic of two Johnsons and an Ellington, David Johnson, Chris Johnson, and Andre Ellington. And Josh Weinfuss made the interesting prediction, saying that Chris Johnson is going to be the starter while David Johnson is the bell cow. Based on what you know and what you've told us and what you've written and said before, that just doesn't jive with the Bruce Arians office. Is that not correct?
Yeah, he's not really, you know, a split carries type of guy. He wants one guy that can carry the load and do it. I mean, now, obviously, he has changed since he's come to Arizona out of necessity. I mean, it's not like he decided to change. You know, he's Rashard Mendenhall injured, Andre Ellington injured, Chris Johnson
injured. Last year, everyone injured.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been a different theme for him since he's been in Arizona. But you know, you look back, Vic Ballard in Indy, you know, he had Fast Willie Parker, he had Rashard Mendenhall in Pittsburgh. He likes to really give about 60 to 65% of the carries to one guy, and then another guy gets about 30%, and then the rest of the carries are all distributed. But I'm interested to see what they're going to do with David Johnson and how they decide they want to, you know, work him. Because I'm of the opinion, and people know my opinion, you get running backs, you run them into the ground, and then you draft a new one. You know, how many running backs end up being really good on their second contract? We could probably count them all on one hand. Recently, I mean. And so, you know, unless David Johnson ends up being one of those guys, and he could be, I'm not saying he cannot, you know, I'm not saying he won't be, but I just think that, you know,
it's hard to project. It's really hard to project. The Cardinals have a history. It's never, ever worked out. You know, no. Literally never worked out with any Cardinals running back.
No. And so what I did, and this is coming up in another article. I wrote another article. Holy cow. We're on fire. Ooh. But I wrote another article because I was interested to see, you know, we lauded what David Johnson did last year, and it was special. I mean, he was excellent. So I went back and looked at, you know, running backs with 100-plus carries that averaged over 4.6 yards per carry, because that's, you know, where David Johnson was at, and who had over 35 receptions as rookies. There was 11 of them since 2000. So it's pretty uncommon. I mean, what he did last year, you know, you figure since 2000, that's 16 NFL seasons and only 11 rookies have ever done it. And then you kind of get into the meat of it, and it's really a dynamic split of highly drafted running backs, either round one or round two. I'll just say day one or day two, because it used to be different back then, but we'll say day one or day two running backs and late round undrafted picks. And then the real shock is to look at what happens in year two, and all of those undrafted guys and late round guys, other than I think one was a third round pick, but he was a smaller back in the Andre Ellington mold. They were not productive, or they were part-time players a la Andre Ellington, who is on this list, by the way. and it's amazing to me to look at the guys that were good. And, you know, there was two guys that were just different. I mean, they were bell cows from day one, Clinton Portis. And I'm spacing on the other name right now, but But then there were two guys. Oh, Chris Johnson. Duh. Young Chris Johnson. But then there were two guys that kind of were in the same mold as David Johnson. Guys that split carries, caught a lot of passes out of the backfield, and were just kind of change of pace options on offense. And they are Joseph Addai from Indy and Maurice Jones-Drew out of Jacksonville. And I kind of see – I kind of hope that David Johnson's trajectory follows Maurice Jones-Drew and not Joseph Addai, who after his first season where he had 1,000 yards rushing and I think he scored 15 combined touchdowns. And then his second season, he had over 1,000 yards rushing and made a Pro Bowl. He then was out of the league quickly 2 years later, 3 years later, because he was so ineffective. So that, you know, I kind of hope he follows that Maurice Jones-Drew trajectory of, you know, maybe this year he goes from 125 carries to about 175 carries. So maybe this is Arian's new way of doing things, that you're going to see Chris Johnson still get 200 carries, but then you're going to see David Johnson get, you know, 175 to 180 carries and 50 to 60 receptions. And that's the way they're going to continue to work him in.
And that's what I want, you know, if Chris Johnson is the starter, I think he'll get more carries, assuming the health of everyone involved. That always is the piece of the puzzle we can't predict.
Exactly.
If Chris Johnson is the starter, Chris Johnson's going to get more carries. Now, David Johnson's going to be an integral part of the offense because he is, you know, he has the same skill set that they got in Andre Ellington a couple of years ago that they tried to feature, only he's bigger and ideally more durable. But the next question is, so where does Andre Ellington fit in? Bruce Arian said today that he still has a role, but he's going to be a bit piece is what it sounds like. He's going to be kind of like how he was last year. He's a kind of a bit piece who might get a few touches at best anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's what he is now. And he is honestly the perfect backup for this team. That he is exactly what this team needs in a backup. And that is somebody who can fill David Johnson's role of being an outside runner and pass catcher while David Johnson assumes the role of Chris Johnson, or knock on wood, God forbid, something happens to David Johnson, he can assume David Johnson's role while Chris Johnson is still the lead back. I think he has the perfect ability to fill either guys, to fill David Johnson's role, no matter what David Johnson is having to do. So he can, you know, either be the 10 carry, 5 catch guy, or he can be the 10 carry, 5 catch guy while David Johnson's getting, you know, 20 to 25 carries in a game.
And that's, you know, it's interesting because back when Ellington was supposed to be the feature guy, the Cardinals were looking for a guy, looking for a back, and one of the guys they brought in was Marion Grice, who has the same type of skill set, the ability to play outside a receiver, to be in the backfield, kind of do the same things. Only Andre Ellington has become that guy to David Johnson, which, you know, is good and bad at the same time because that means their depth is in it. If you look at 1, 2, 3 in terms of skill set, how many teams in the league have 3 starting caliber running backs? I don't know if we could call – is Ellington a starting caliber running back anymore? But he certainly was at one time. So the Cardinals,
I mean, he definitely has this – yeah, he definitely has the skill set for it. It's just he never is healthy. I mean, literally never from freshman year till now. He's never healthy for a season.
And the question is now, how good can that rushing offense be? You know, Arian's not a big run-the-ball guy, but yet they still were number 8 in the rush last year. And you know, Chris Johnson says, I'm sure it was a bit hyperbole, and it was tempered with a lot. If we get better every day and we work hard, there's no reason why he can't see this team being the number one rushing offense in the NFL, which seems kind of crazy when it's Bruce Arians, who loves to throw the ball. But here the Cardinals had the fourth best passing attack last year and the eighth best running attack last year. Is it really absurd to think that they could potentially be the top rushing team in the NFL? I mean, I don't think it's likely, but I could see it happening.
Well, I mean, you look at Arians run offenses, and I'm trying to go through them right now. So overall rushing offense, let's just do attempts. I mean, they were ninth last year, 24th and 20th. I mean, he's hovered around that 20 mark for a while, you know, dating back to Pittsburgh. And after 2007, it was, you know, third in rushing attempts. And then 2008, when they won the Super Bowl, ninth in rushing attempts. And then it jumps up to 18. So I could see him. You know, it's funny to me, you know, may not be funny to other people, but it's funny to me that his best offense or his best success has come when he runs the ball more. Obviously, third in 2007, AFC Championship game, ninth in 2008, Super Bowl champion, eighth in 2010, I want to say they were in the AFC Championship game again. Yeah, so AFC Championship game, Super Bowl. They lost eighth, the Super Bowl. Yeah.
And then eighth this year in the conference
championship game. So, you know, when he has a top 10 attempts running game, well, you know, I know that people like to say, oh, when you run the ball a lot, that doesn't mean you win more games. But it tends to mean that you're playing from ahead, and therefore you can run the ball more to run out the clock.
And that's really the Arians thing. If the Cardinals can play offensively like they did early in the season, they could have a number one running offense, because he will run more when they're winning. And if they're playing even or behind, the running game gets thrown out the window. And that's just, we've seen that from Arians. We saw from Wisenhunt. It's just they didn't have any skill at the position, so it never came back. So the Arians, as long as they're playing ahead, will be a consistent runner of the football.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of his game. That's part of what he likes to do. It's just he's so hard-headed and quick, like you said, to abandon the run when things aren't going as well as he feels like they should.
Right. And that's essentially what it is. But let's kind of move on to one of the last couple of topics. We kind of wrap things up in the next few minutes. Veteran additions. The kind of consensus thing is the Cardinals need to add a veteran cornerback. They need to add a veteran right tackle. What level of need do you see them having of adding that depth, or whether it's someone to compete or adding depth? Do they need to do that?
No, I think they're good at right tackle. I like the idea of Wadford pushing Humphreys, and the idea of Cole Toner or the kid from Canada, I think it is. Is that right? The board or whatever guy?
Eli Buka.
No. Who's the offensive tackle?
No. Clay DeBoard out of Eastern Clay Washington.
DeBoard. Okay, yeah, Eastern Washington. Washington, Canada, all the same thing. But, you know, I like the idea of DeBoard pushing as well. So those guys, you know, I think Wadford is a veteran presence enough to push Humphreys. And I didn't think he was that bad last year. Was he great? No. Was he, you know, good? Maybe not. But I didn't think he was bad. Cornerback.
No.
That cornerback is a whole different ball of wax. I mean, I don't know what to think. And part of the reason I don't know what to think is because Justin Bethel isn't even on the field. So, you know, what do you expect from Bethel when he's not even out there right now because of surgery on the, you know, fracture of his foot or whatever it was. So I would still like a veteran corner on this roster. Doesn't mean he has to make the roster. I just think it'd be good for right now, especially as things are progressing through. But I think veteran corner is more of an importance than veteran veteran tackle.
Well, and you know, granted, yes, we've got there's Watford. But in terms of a veteran presence, I mean, they don't really need that on the offensive line because they have a line full of veterans. You've got Beldir, you've got Upati, you've got Mathis, you've got Shipley. And the fact that they have Watford and he's passable tells you that, you know, I think they're okay at right tackle. And it's not like there's some, you know, there's no Eric Winston on the market right now. There's no... If you're going to get a veteran with there's no, you know, there is a Lyle Sandlin on the market, but there's, unless you're getting a starter, potential starter quality, there's really no point to it because you already have veterans. Now, a cornerback is a different beast because, and Aaron kind of touched on that today at practice. He's like, you don't just want to get an old guy just to get an old guy because trust me, there's a lot of bad old guys out there and we pick on them every week. They do have some veterans in. They've got Sean Prater. They've got Asa Jackson. So they've got some guys with a little bit of experience. But aside from it, you know, just bringing in a veteran cornerback, well, if they wanted a veteran cornerback, they had every opportunity to bring back Jerrod Powers.
And it was cheap.
It was cheap. And he's as good or better than any of the cornerbacks. The veteran quarterbacks that are available now. Leon Hall, yes, but he's essentially Jerrod Powers, is he not?
Right, and I think the other thing is he's probably here's the thing with like the veteran cornerback. And this is where people like me look at it differently than, you know, people like Bruce Arians and Steve Keim. I know what I'm getting in Jerrod Powers. I know where the flaws are. We still don't know if there's going to be any improvement from Justin Bethel. We're expecting it, and I'm expecting it, you're expecting it, we're all expecting it, but we don't know if we're getting it, right? So... Exactly. Like that's where my desire for a veteran that we know what we're getting from them comes in, as opposed to, oh, let's have these growing pains of Brandon Williams and Justin Bethel and Harlan Miller play out. And I'm just like, ugh. I mean, that's just, and again, that's my opinion. That's how I like to, you know, see teams constructed, because I think as the season ends, the cream rises to the top and you see guys like who made the Malcolm Butler from the Patriots, you know, have to step up and make plays, and so it gives them time to integrate into, as opposed to what I think happens a lot of times with corners that are young. They go out there and they struggle early, and then they lose confidence and the team loses confidence in them as well. That's what my, you know, lone concern is with that idea.
And that makes sense. The one thing that the only thing that concerns me about this offseason has been the fact that Bethel hasn't been out there. But at the same time, he's had to take more responsibility. It's giving the young players a chance to step up and get reps while Bethel can take mental reps, and which is, you know, he needs the reps on the field, and he's going to get that during training camp. But when you're now, and here's the thing for me, it's not like there are a ton of good number two corners in the league. When you have a Patrick Peterson on one side, there's always going to be a drop-off. Always.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That's the thing. there's going to be a drop off guaranteed. And so you need to, I mean, that you have to expect. And the difference is, how much of is it going to be down to Bethel, and how much different would that be with any other player? The thing with Bethel out there is that you have the potential that the highs are near Patrick Peterson level high plays. What you hope is that the floor comes up. Because with Gerard Powers, you had a very high floor and you had an okay ceiling. But they want to go beyond that. And I think that's what the whole thing is.
Exactly. And but it's very, I mean, it's very rare. I mean, the 2014 Patriots had, you know, a very talented secondary. Obviously, the Seahawks continually have a strong secondary. A lot of
Broncos.
That is scheme-based. The Broncos. But theirs were, much like what the Cardinals are doing now, you know, Aqib Talib was signed to come in and play. But the rest of those guys at the corner position were drafted. So, you know, the Cardinals are building in the same way, except that their Aqib Talib was Patrick Peterson. So that's what, you know, you look at from that vantage point. But everything else is similar. You know, you have to hope that Justin Bethel becomes Chris Harris Jr. or Bradley Roby. You know, you have to hope that he becomes this type of player.
And then so kind of the wrapped up the show now, final topic, All or Nothing, the Amazon video series. I don't know how excited you are. I cannot wait to watch this. I'm interested to see what are the things that they did. Now, there are some things, you know, being around the team as I have over the past couple of years, I do know some of this stuff, but I'm really kind of interested. Now, spoiler, but you know how it ends. I mean, they're going to lose in Carolina. We know that. But the way it's being talked about, this could be some very gripping television. You get to see the Cardinals more intimately in their homes. You know, this is the sort of things I think that it's the beginning of something even more that fans want. We want more. The NFL is so big. We just want more. We want more. We want more. I think this is the next step. And I think the Cardinals have, you know, sort of pioneered something that we're going to see more and more, especially on a team that Arizona is exciting. Now, it's a very exciting team nationally.
And they have a lot of great characters. Patrick Peterson, obviously, Tyrann Mathieu, Larry Fitzgerald.
And Bruce Arians, holy cow.
And that's what I was going to say. And then they're led by, you know, they're led by maybe the second or third most popular, you know, coach in terms of media coverage in the league. I think people love Pete Carroll still. I'm trying to think who else. Rex Ryan still, obviously. And the difference, well, obviously not Pete Carroll, but the difference between like Arians and Rex Ryan is his blovation. his what? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear
Arians
you.
Have had success.
Exactly. Arians backs up the crap he talks, so to speak. So, I think it's going to be a fun look. I'm upset that we're going to see, you know, an inside look at the end of the season. That's disappointing. Like, you could cut it off after the Green Bay game and I'd be good to go. Like, the first Green Bay game, not the second one. I don't even want to watch that. So just cut it off before that Seattle game. And let's just, you know, call it a season and forget about everything else that happened after that.
Although I am sort of interested in to see how in depth they go with how the playoffs did, the Seattle game, to kind of see, because, you know, I have my thoughts and my perspective from being in the locker room. I wasn't there in Carolina, to perhaps get a different perspective as to what in the world happened down the stretch where they were rolling so well and then they just looked like a bad team. after that. And a bad team against Seattle, a lucky team against Green Bay, and a terrible team against Carolina. So yeah, I wonder if, if there's anything we can kind of get it. They can crack open the psyche of the players at all. I'm interested at least in that. I mean, I've gotten over the loss at this point. I'm not hurt by it anymore. Obviously it's disappointing. So it's not going to open up any old wounds for me, at least for me. And so I'm interested in seeing how that develops and how they wrap up the show and what they look at and how they do that narrative.
Yeah, I'm not. that's just me as a fan. Like that's how I react as a fan. You know, I don't ever watch the 08 tapes at all. Like I never watch that stuff. I'd rather sit in misery of watching the 2010 to 2012 seasons than heart-wrenching losses like the Super Bowl, or even last year.
Ben Roethlisberger sidestepped Darnell Dockett, and Francisco fall down. And
yeah, see, I'd rather watch John Skelton play football than watch that stuff. That's just me as a fan. It's how I'm wired as a fan, because I'd rather watch and be like, this team sucks, than go, man, if this one thing was different. I hate that, so I can't do that.
All right. Well, I think we've talked long enough. We probably should have had another show before now, so we didn't creep up on, an hour 15? If you're still listening, fantastic. Thanks. I hope you're still listening. As we wrap up another show, I believe is show number 119 of Revenge of the Birds Radio. We're wrapping up our off-season coverage. We might have another show next week. Other than that, we might be on hiatus for the most part, unless there's Tyrann Mathieu contract news, at least a show between Seth and myself. We'll see if we'll do another show before training camp or until right before training camp, but we might be on the edge of, taking a little bit of break as the team breaks for the summer as well. So thanks for listening. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Rue. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio. You know how to get a hold of us, revengeofthebirds.com. NFL Draft Breakdown Podcast, that's his show. Facebook, Twitter, you know how to get this hold. If you don't know, look us up. You can Google us. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You've been listening to Revenge of the Birds. Keep the conversation going by visiting revengeofthebirds.com. Follow us on Twitter at Revenge of Birds. You can also find us on iTunes at facebook.com/Revenge of the Birds.